everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at I Eat Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I have a great show for you today. My guest is Gia Giasolo from the Brooklyn Pharmacy and Soda Fountain. And I stumbled upon the Brooklyn Pharmacy and Soda Fountain a couple months back and was just so delighted, and I'm really thrilled to have Gia on, and I'll be bringing her on in a little while. But first I want to talk to you about some things going on in around the city, around the country, and of course share one of my favorite recipes with you. So first off, there's so many things coming up in the next few weeks as we get into fall. Of course, the biggest one is coming up this Sunday, which I'm sure most of you know about, but if you don't, you need to. And you also need to share the word and bring those that don't know. I know I was talking to my husband yesterday. He was saying he was at a business meeting, and nobody in the business meeting knew about the climate march. And to me, I find it so hard to believe because I get at least 20 to 50 emails a day about this thing. So this Sunday, September 21st, is the People's Climate March, which is going to be the largest climate march in the history of the world. It's set out to be huge, huge, huge. I'm going to pull it up right now so I can share with you some of how it's going to lay out. They are meeting starting at, well, it starts at 11:30, the march. So you want to get there by 10 o'clock, 10:30. You know, I've been told that the police are going to shut down the streets if it gets too busy. So if you want to get there and be counted, plan on getting there early. It's broken up into contingencies. And the contingencies is just to try to segregate the areas so that people with common interests can march together. And, of course, there's so many overlaps, and we could probably all fit in on so many different ones all at the same time. But this is going to be meeting starting at Columbus Circle, and then it goes up between 59th Street all the way to 86th Street. And it's broken up into different groups. And at the front of the line are people at the front of the line dealing with the crisis and climate change. And that would be indigenous groups, environmental justice, and other frontline groups, Hurricane Sandy survivors, Katrina survivors, that kind of thing. Then there's going to be families, labor families, students, elders in the next group, which is called We Can Build the Future. Then the third group is We Have Solutions, and that's where I'll be marching with I Eat Green and the Long Island Food Coalition, the Brooklyn Food Coalition, Slow Food, North Shore, lots of renewable energy, food and water justice, Food and Water Watch will be there, environmental organizations and such. That's the third group. That group is meeting on 72nd Street, and you're going to have access to 72nd Street through 77th Street or 77th Street or 82nd Street. So you won't be able to actually walk down 72nd Street. The police are really going to have these streets blocked off. So what I recommend you all do is go to the peoplesclimate.org, and that's the website where you can find out the route, find out all the information that you want to. If you want to volunteer, you can sign up for volunteering there. But the march is going to start at Columbus Circle, walk down 59th Street to 6th Avenue, then walk down 6th Avenue to 42nd Street, then walk 42nd Street west to 11th Avenue, and then down to 34th Street. At each of the gathering sites for the different contingents, there will be speakers and performers at that point. There is no one big stage for everybody. So I know in the food justice contingent, we will be having Vandana Shiva there to speak with us. I know we will have dancers. Ilana Emeta will be a dancing performer there. There will be musicians there, drummers there. So each contingent will have a different speaker and different entertainment. So come and be counted. Please spread the word. This is going to be a peaceful march. It's going to be an opportunity for us all to take action and let the people watching, let that all the people that are in New York starting Monday for the United Nations Climate Summit, 2014 Climate Summit, let them know that climate change is not just a reality, but needs to be a deciding factor in all future decisions that we make towards energy, towards the environment, towards social justice. We need to be thinking of the environment in all of the decisions we make. And everything is connected. And as a foodie, I can tell you that food connects all these pieces together. Our environment, whether it's the fracking and the GMO issue, the economy, buying local, supporting our local farmers, the environment when it comes to all the GMOs and the pesticides that are being sprayed. And that's something I would like to ask you all to do as well. When you go to my website, I always have petitions on my website, and this week I have two really important petitions that I'd like you to participate in. One is to prevent the Pebble Mine in Bristol Bay, and this is the home of 40 million sockeye salmon, and what they are looking to do right now will devastate the environment and all of the salmon fishes up in that area, and will affect the waterways coming downstream from there. So it's really, really important that we take a stand there and let the Environmental Protection Agency know that we want them to reject the Pebble Mine to protect Bristol Bay and the surrounding area. Also, those of us that care about the food we eat and are making choices to eat organic, want to know that the organic food we're getting is truly organic. And with the spraying that they're doing right now, especially with the new pesticide that Dow company is trying to get approved called Enlist Duo, will not only merge the Roundup pesticide, now it's going to also merge this new pesticide that some of the ingredients also went into Agent Orange. We want to sign this petition and let the EPA know that we do not want them to approve Dow's new chemical. It's just going to up the ante and require more pesticides, more spraying, and the wind drift from the spraying goes on to the neighboring organic farm, and those farmers are also losing their licensing. So we need to take a stand and protect that. So anyway, I'm hoping everybody out there, you know, will be joining us in the march, the People's Climate March on September 21st. And leading up to that, there's many exciting things going on. From September 19th to the 21st, there's the Climate Convergence, which is People, Planet, and Peace over Profit. And if you go to the website Converge for Climate, you'll see a whole lineup starting with Friday afternoon at 4 o'clock going all the way until Sunday. There are speakers, lectures, sign-making workshops, all kinds of different activities going on starting Friday leading up to the Climate March. So check that out. Today, meaning tonight, the Brooklyn Grange is hosting an end-of-the-season rooftop soiree. That's going to be at the Brooklyn Navy Yard on their rooftop, Building 3. I believe there's still tickets left if you want to go to, I think Edible Manhattan has the tickets. I know the Cleaver Company is providing the food. Mary Cleaver is a wonderful advocate for local, organic, good food. She's become kind of like the New York foodie caterer. So she's great, and the food will be made by them. So check out the rooftop soiree tonight. This afternoon, if you're free from 11:30 to 1, right after my show, if you can meet at the Plaza Hotel, a rally is going, or a fundraiser is going on for Women for Cuomo, and Governor Cuomo will be there. And so there's a rally to ban fracking going on from 11:30 to 1, if you can get to that. September 21st, after the Climate March, If you want to head out to Long Island at Restoration Farm, they're having a farm-to-table dinner. You do need to make a reservation, so go onto their website, restorationfarm.org, or com, I'm actually not sure, but it's Restoration Farm in Bethpage. Tickets are $40 for adults and $20 for kids. They are going to be serving their own pasture-raised pork, homemade organic sides and desserts. Bring your own booze. And our local Rusty String Band will be hosting the music there. So that should be a fun evening if you can get there after the People's March. September 23rd, I'm hosting a socially responsible investing dinner at a private home in Lloyd Harbor with a group of investors from Morgan Stanley. And this will be an opportunity to learn how to invest with an impact and to divest from all companies like Monsanto and biotech companies and fossil fuel companies, the ones that we do not want to support, and to actually support sustainable agricultural companies and things that are making a difference in the direction that you want to see things go, things that are ethically and morally in alignment with your belief system. So, we all want to invest our money and try to make our money last so that we can someday retire. Anyway, this is a great opportunity to learn about that. September 27th, Long Island Naturally Environmental Fair. This is an annual event Starflower Experiences has out on Long Island. So you should come to that. Also, there is a fall harvest and potluck at the Sylvia Center's farm in Kinderhook. That's upstate New York, but the Sylvia Center is a great nonprofit bringing cooking classes to kids who need it. So if you are into taking a ride into the beautiful fall upstate in Kinderhook, it's an all-day event. It's free. There is one cooking class that costs $5. If you want to pre-register for that, go to the Sylvia Center's website. I'm also doing a cooking demo at the Floral Park Library on October 2nd. Also on October 2nd, there is a conference or a workshop called Weathering the Storm, Restoring Faith, Justice, and Resilience to Climate-Impacted Communities. That's at the Copacabana on West 47th Street from 10 to 4. Check that out. And then October 3rd, Slow Food USA is welcoming Carlo Petrini and Alice Waters at Roberta's in Brooklyn to celebrate the Silver Snail. So that's at noon at Roberta's on October 3rd. And, God, I could keep going on, but I think the best thing, since I don't want to take too much time with all these events, because it's amazing how many there are, go to my website, ieatgreen.com, and there's a list of all of these things. October 11th, there's a global frackdown, which is a really big event going on everywhere. We have a gathering locally on Long Island to ban fracking and to also to stand up to stop the Port Ambrose liquefied gas facility, where they want to bring liquefied gas in right off the shore of Long Island and New Jersey and store it there. Not a good idea. So that's going to be in Long Beach at the Boardwalk and National Boulevard. And October 14th, Slow Food North Shore is continuing with the Food on Film series showing The Sturgeon Queen, which is about Russin Daughters on the Lower East Side. It's a great film. If you haven't seen it, come out for that. And Slow Food North Shore is going to be hosting a reception with all of the delicious Jewish dairy food that Russin Daughters specializes in. So come on down for that. Again, check out my website at IE Green for more information about this weekend's march and all of these events that I mentioned. Now I'd like to share with you my recipe, which is a Mediterranean tofu and eggplant and tomato dish. You're going to be seeing lots of eggplant and tomato dishes right now because that's what I'm harvesting so much of. Of course, I have lots of collard greens coming out and kale, and the garden is just amazing. It keeps giving. It's lovely. So this is a Mediterranean tofu dish. You're going to need some olive oil. You want to have some really good quality olive oil. One cake of extra firm organic tofu cut into cubes. One onion cut in half and sliced into crescent moons. I use 3 long Asian eggplants cut into cubes. That's because that's what I have, but it's also because I really love the Asian eggplants. But if you only have an Italian one. I'm sure that will work just fine. 1 pint of cherry tomatoes cut in half. 1 tablespoon chopped garlic. 1 teaspoon cumin. 1/4 teaspoon cinnamon. 1/4 teaspoon cloves. And 1/4 teaspoon allspice. And then I put a little tamari in as well for tasting. Some water and 2 tablespoons of chopped parsley at the end for garnish. Start out by laying out the cubes of tofu on a dry towel. Cover with another towel and just press lightly to dry out the tofu. Meanwhile, toss the eggplant cubes with some olive oil and bake them at 425 for 15 minutes until soft. And this is a step I do just so that I can get the eggplant soft without stir-frying them. When you stir-fry eggplant, they absorb so much oil. They're delicious, but they absorb a lot of oil. And I have found that by baking it in the oven with just tossing it with a little olive oil, I can get the eggplants really soft and delicious and not use so much oil. Then I cover the bottom of a cast iron pan with olive oil. When it's hot, add the tofu and allow the tofu to develop a golden skin on the bottom just by shaking the pan, but don't try to turn it yet. You want to wait until you get a nice golden skin on one edge before you start turning it. Once you have that golden skin, you can turn it and try to, you know, turn the tofus over and try to get a golden skin on another side. Add the garlic and onions and continue cooking at a medium-high heat, stirring constantly for 5 minutes. Also, if you allow the tofu to get that skin, it won't fall apart so easily. That's one of the complaints I hear from people so often, is how the tofu falls apart when they're stir-frying it. So it's really important to first get that golden brown skin on one side before you start to turn it. Then you add the cooked eggplant and the spices and stir for a few more minutes. Then add the cherry tomatoes. Let just all that come together and get hot. Then add a few splashes of tamari just for taste and a little bit of water, and reduce the heat to low and cover it and let it simmer for about 5 minutes. Then add the fresh parsley for garnish. And that is it. It's very easy. Comes together really quick. As I said, I roast the eggplant to reduce the oil, but if you want to not use another pan, then it's easier for you to just throw it into the wok. You can do that too. Okay? Now it's my pleasure to introduce Gia Giasullo. She is one of the co-founders and proprietor of Brooklyn Pharmacy and Soda Fountain. And Gia was classically trained by some of the giants in the field of graphic design when she graduated from College of Art and Design in San Francisco. And Gia oversees the design, styling, and social media for the pharmacy. Prior to her commitment to the pharmacy, she co-founded Studio EG, an internationally acclaimed studio for sustainable design, and continues to do book design on the side. And she is responsible for this beautiful book that I have right here in my hand called The Soda Fountain, which came out last year, and it's a great, great book about the history of soda fountains. And it's really quite fascinating, and the pictures alone are just incredible. So, Gia, are you with me?
I am with you. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you so much for joining us on the show today.
Thank you. Thank you as well for having me.
Sure. So can you start by just sharing with everyone, what is a soda fountain? To those of us that are old enough, we remember as a child a soda fountain.
Right.
But I think a lot of listeners might not really know about that and that history.
Right. Well, technically the soda fountain is the piece of machinery that we have behind our counter. We have a Bastian Blessing. So technically a soda fountain is the apparatus that the seltzer flows from, that houses all of your carbonation and your toppings, et cetera. But a soda fountain as a place is a quintessentially American establishment and had a real heyday for about 3 generations in America, and kind of a rise and then a fall pretty much after World War II. When we think of a soda fountain, most of us think about sort of the place that our grandfather worked or our parents met. We've heard so many personal stories. The soda fountain had a place in the community in America. At one point, I think there's an estimate of about 125,000 soda fountains existed in America, oftentimes on main streets, on the corner, that were really an essential part of the community for both young people and old people. Teenagers worked there. And the probably, you know, right after the World War II, there was a decline in the soda fountains for several different reasons. But when we opened our doors in 2010, there's not really an exact number of pure soda fountains, but probably less than 50, if not less than that. A lot of soda fountains these days kind of are part of a larger, you know, part of a diner or part of a bar. But true soda fountains are pretty rare these days. But as we've seen, they're making a little bit of a comeback, which is very exciting for us.
Mm-hmm. And I think most soda fountains used to be housed in with a pharmacy. I think that's why you call it Brooklyn Pharmacy and Soda Fountain. Why was that?
You know, sort of again, back to the carbonation aspect. There was a time when seltzer was considered, and still is, a medicinal drink. You know, if we're not feeling well, we have a ginger ale or we have something carbonated. And so the American Medical Institute only licensed pharmacists to administer seltzer. And so the apparatuses and the carbonation machinery, they were installed in pharmacies, and the pharmacist would, you know, administer seltzer. And what the pharmacist understood pretty quickly was that if you add a little something sweet to that, you have, voila, soda. And sometimes even the medicine could be dropped into the seltzer. So the soda and the soda fountain was born within the context of a medicinal setting, actually.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I didn't know that until reading your book. And it's really, the book is really great because the way you break it up with the history in the front and then more of the recipes in the back. When you were researching for this book, are there any other really fascinating or surprising things that you discovered?
Well, I mean, there's the historical part, and then there's the personal part. I think that in our, you know, when we opened up the Brooklyn Pharmacy and Soda Fountain, a lot of it was based on, we had sort of stumbled onto this beautiful old pharmacy that had been shut down and was in a thriving community, but it was actually a, you know, very preserved interior. So we came from this from a place of just own personal interest. What we didn't understand is that the soda fountain had, you know, very steady thread through people's personal history. So one of the surprising things about opening a soda fountain was the realization that the soda fountain played a part in so many people's lives. And so from the moment we opened our doors, people walked in with their own stories about, you know, growing up with soda fountains, and again, sort of where their parents might have met, that their uncle had a soda fountain or was a pharmacist. I think that one of the things that was surprising to us is when the heyday of the soda fountain was, because we oftentimes think of soda fountains, their heyday being in the 50s, but in fact those were more malt shops and they were already burger joints at that point. But when we think of soda fountains, we think of the 50s. But in fact they really had their golden age, so to speak, which corresponded actually with the Gilded Age in America. It was a time of incredible innovation. A lot of it was around industry. There's a wonderful trade magazine that we researched. It's at the New York Public Library, called The Soda Fountain. And you can see in this trade magazine the incredible energy around this industry. We likened it almost to the real estate industry today. It's a to get rich. You know, if you want to get rich, open up a soda fountain. It was a very, you know, spoke to sort of like the alive and the awake enterprising entrepreneurs. So that we were surprised that the heyday of the soda fountain really was at the turn of, you know, the last 20 years of the 19th century. And it very much corresponded with the sort of the invigorated industry that was happening in America. It was very stimulating. So the, you know, the enterprising entrepreneurial soda fountain had a new piece of equipment every 6 months. They changed their menu continually. They had creative things to offer. And so it's mirrored that energy in America.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that was sort of the surprising part for us, is that, you know, that there was a history part of it that was misplaced as like the 50s, but actually in fact soda fountains were from, you know, the 1890s and through to the 40s were really when they had their major strength in America.
Right. Now, what's your personal background that brought you to opening up a soda fountain?
not being a soda jerk, that's for sure.
That's another thing I want to mention is that name, the soda jerk. I mean, Your shirts are great. Let's just say jerk on them. Yeah, but usually you think of some, you know, calling someone a jerk as being a derogatory term, but it's really not in soda, in the soda
fountain world.
No, we
actually say that a jerk is it's a noun, a verb, and an adjective in our store. The name Soda Jerk really comes from a verb, which is a jerking of the seltzer tap. So you kind of pull back on the lever and the seltzer is administered to, you know, down. And so the jerking is really just about the motion of the hand. And so it used to be that soda jerks, the people that served you, were called dispensers, which it's interesting because when we think of a soda dispenser now, we think of a button that we push and the soda just comes out. In fact, originally, the people that were serving you were called dispensers. And then it switched to being called soda jerks. But yes, it's a term of endearment in our soda fountain.
Right.
My personal background, I think you mentioned, I graduated in graphic design, and I was trained with some of the sort of last great giants of old school design, where we were, you know, hand lettering and we were not on the computer, which was funny because we were right in the backyard of Silicon Valley and all of the things that were happening with the Macintosh. But I had a pretty strict training that involved a lot of, you know, hand skill. And but then shortly after I came out of school, around 1994, the Macintosh was already, you know, deeply into my field, or and vice versa. And so 20 some odd years later, I found that what had originally drawn me into design and art, which was a lot about, you know, working in teams, being tactile, colors, color swatches, all of the tactile parts of design, had really been condensed to me and my computer. And, you know, even my book design, which had, again, sort of started off with these wonderful design meetings and working with photographers, had been reduced to me ordering stock imagery online. And so I was at a personal point in my life, also with children that were, you know, elementary school, feeling like I needed to have a little bit more of a three-dimensional experience in my life, and was seeking a way to have that happen. And then on the other side of it is my brother, who's my younger brother. His background had been in kitchen gardening and landscaping, but he always had a natural knack for cooking. He also always had a natural knack for teaching, and we joked about him that he would either open his own diner or become a fifth grade social studies teacher. That he had those qualities for him that would make him a great fit for either one. And so he took a room up in an apartment on the corner of Henry and Sackett, and below on the ground level was this apothecary store that had been pretty much shut down for about 14 years. And it was a space that had, for two generations in Carroll Gardens, been an apothecary store called Longo's Pharmacy. And it was the kind of pharmacy that, you know, you walk in and you describe your ailments, and they would actually make up and concoct things on the spot. So everything was behind the counter. It wasn't the kind of place you just walk in and grab something off the shelf. They had sold the building around like 1960s, around that time, to the previous owner that we came onto. And he had kind of opened and closed. He was in a neighborhood that wasn't quite ready for where his interests were. He was a pharmacist, but he was more into homeopathy. And so we believe that he was just a little bit before his time, that he wasn't quite interested in being completely pharmaceutical, quite in the right space or time to be opening up a holistic, you know, apothecary store. And so he opened and closed, and it became this place, this corner store, very visible, an intersection in the community, that just became this mystery spot because nobody ever had moved out. So there was relics in there from, you know, early 1900s. Nobody had ever moved anything out. He wasn't a collector, but he was a bit of a hoarder. And so when my brother moved upstairs, he became fascinated with this, you know, kind of boarded up mystery spot downstairs, and he became friends with him. They shared some common interests around eating holistically, farmers markets, etc. And my brother was the first person that he handed the key over to and said, yeah, I'll agree to you cleaning it out. I started speaking to my brother, and we, you know, he had come up with this idea of a soda fountain, and I was being a big sister and sort of telling him what to do it like this and do it like that. And at a certain point, he just said to me, why don't you come here and do it with me? It was the first idea that the landlord, who was pretty stuck in what to do, it was the first idea that he agreed to. And partly it's because he understood the community value of the soda fountain and what that would bring to the neighborhood. Uh-huh. And so the trajectory of how we got from, you know, point A to point B, you know, lots of different twists and turns, but it was somewhat serendipitous because almost like the spot found us. I feel like this little spot here in Carroll Gardens, this particular place, was a soda fountain that was just waiting to be born. The pharmacy that they had, the Longos, didn't have a soda fountain. And so, but at the same time, when you walk into our space, it looks as if the counter has always been there.
Right.
So, it's really our belief that it was just a soda fountain that was just waiting to be born, and we were the right people at the right time. For me, it was a wonderful leap into exactly what I was looking for, which is community, creativity, physical work, which I enjoy very much, and family business, which we've enjoyed working together. We have our ups and our downs, as anybody would, but there's something very unique and special about working with family. When it works, it really works very nicely. So,
right.
That's the short story.
Yes. More often you hear about times when it's not working, so that's great.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we have different skill sets. He's definitely the soda jerk. He has a wonderful, hosting personality, and he's wonderful with kids and really, makes them feel like they're the star when they walk in. One of the things that continues to be, to me, one of the sweetest aspects of the soda fountain is that it's, so many places when they open up that are new and trendy, they're really marketing to a certain crowd. And the soda fountain has always been a place that, whether you're 2 or 80, it's a familiar place and it's a comfortable place. It's your place. And I think that's still true today. So we say that, it's very wonderful when parents bring their kids in, that's the natural. But when kids bring their parents in, whether their parents are, whether they're 4 and they're bringing in their parents, or whether they're 40 and they're bringing in their parents. And we see that a lot. And that's very nice for us to see that cross section from, toddlers to teenagers to, people that are retired and stopping in for an egg cream. So that remains true of the soda fountain's culture that we're very proud of.
Mm-hmm. And do you find that the store has also, you talk about it as community, do people hang out there, or they come there and then they leave? Or do you have you gotten into doing events or anything like that to have people hang out for longer periods?
Yeah, well, one of the things that we ascribe to is that we pretty much say yes to anything. So if somebody comes to us and says, hey, I've got an idea for this, we're like, let's try that. And that's led us to, we have a community-supported agriculture with Local Roots New York. So we have a CSA, we serve as a CSA pickup on Tuesdays. And that's been going on for almost 4 of the 5 years that we've been open. And that's something that kind of brings people in every Tuesday afternoon through till 8 o'clock at night, with both, winter and summer shares. We also have an old time fiddle jam on Tuesday evenings. Any levels, people come in. Sometimes it's a little screechy and sometimes it's absolutely wonderful. So we kind of open that up. We do a toddler sing along on Thursdays. And really, those are the things that we kind of continually do, but we add to them as people walk in and say, "Hey, I'd like to try this."
Right.
And that's important to us, to serve as a community in that way.
Right. That's great. Well, so often, as a natural food chef, I'm always, looking for places where people can get healthy treats. And mm-hmm. one of the things that impressed me with your place is that you're not buying, the prepackaged pumps of vanilla syrup that are all artificially flavored, et cetera, et cetera. You're actually making your syrups. Can you share, some of your recipes and what makes your soda fountain so unique?
Yeah, well, one of the things, and the reason why we kept the farm, farmacy, is that it was our goal in the beginning. And I still feel like we're on our path about honing in on this concept. We really wanted to be very conscious about what we were making our treats out of. And so it began with our ice cream. We work with Adirondack Creamery in the Hudson Valley. It's a small-time ice, or not small-time, it is a small ice cream maker. And he gets his cream from Hudson Valley Fresh. And they're both, you know, he can sometimes see the cows that are heading off to the farm. So he actually even can see the cows that are going to be making the next batch of ice cream. It's also the same milk that we run through our fountain to make our egg cream. So we have this nice milk cream loop. You know, no hormones, not triple pasteurized milk, and no chemicals in our ice cream whatsoever. We only run six flavors. We're not, you know, we're not running 100 different flavors.
You're not Baskin Robbins.
Different flavoring, right. And so we're really able to hone in on some very good ice cream, and you can taste it immediately. And then with our toppings or with our with the things that we put on top of our ice cream, because ice cream needs a topping. You know, again, fresh whipped cream made from the Hudson Valley fresh cream, and you can taste the difference in that.
Absolutely.
We do some wonderful, yeah. Seasonally, we just got done harvesting and making all of our syrups from Jersey berries of blueberries and strawberry. Produced a fantastic yield this summer of fresh syrups. And so with all of our syrups, we make them. It's a simple process. Actually, we go through it in the book as well, of making a simple syrup. So our sodas are mixed on the spot. You know, you come in, you order a blueberry soda, you'll see us grab a glass, put some ice into it, and we'll be pouring out of a glass jar our condensed blueberry syrup. And to that we add about 10 ounces of cold sparkling seltzer, again from the tap. And then we'll see us mix it. So we're mixing you with soda, no chemicals. And, you know, when the season is right, we've got a, you know, bunch of fresh fruit syrups. But all of our syrups are made without preservatives, and, you know, we make them in small batches so we can do that. They all freeze very well. So if we make a batch of 12 quarts of syrups, you know, we go through them before we would ever need to add any kind of preservative. And so that's,
but you make it when it's in season, you make a whole batch and freeze it to last you throughout the winter. No?
We just wonderful blueberries, great yield this summer. So we've got blueberries and strawberries, and that'll probably take us right through November. But we'll start with our citruses, with our orange and grapefruit. Will be coming in, so then we'll be making those syrups. So we have some that we kind of steadily make, lemon, lime. We make some, you know, cherry syrup, and then we'll bring in our seasonal. And then the other aspect that we try to do is to source locally. Excuse me. If we're not making our own toppings, then we'll source locally. North Fork potato chips. They're a potato farmer out in North Fork. Wonderful story of a company that, you know, they're potato farmers, but they were looking for a secondary economy for their farm. And so they developed these wonderful kettle chips. So we heard about them, went to visit them, and for 3 years now have been featuring their delicious potato chips on our Potato Head, Mr. Potato Head Sunday. This is a Sunday that we had created just for Father's Day 1 year, and it's never went off the menu. Delicious.
Wow.
And it's been great because we just continually order their chips and feature them. And but then when we talk about local, and this is a conversation we have a lot, it's like, what does local mean to us? I mean, local can mean next door. Local can also, for us, mean supporting a local economy that's maybe not right next door. And for as an example, we were raised for a good part of our life, my brother and I, in the backwoods of Maine. Not a huge economy up there, but it's been our goal and effort to send money to that local community. And so one of the things that we do is actually our second grade teacher and his wife, they harvest and make maple syrup. And so we committed, you know, we knew that we were going to be using maple syrup on our brunch menu. We went to the source of the local community we wanted to support. The shipping was not astronomical. And whenever we get up to Maine, we'll actually then bring it back with us. But as a way to sort of continually send money to a local community that needs support. So we're always looking at what do we mean by local. And that's an ongoing conversation for us.
Right, right. Let's take a couple-minute break. When we come back, I want to talk about some of the other specialties that you feature at your soda fountain.
Sure.
So, everyone, I'm talking with Gia Giasullo. from the Brooklyn Pharmacy and Soda Fountain, and I'm Bhavani from IE Green, and we'll be right back. Don't go anywhere. Hello, everybody. And welcome back. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I'm here with my guest today, Gia Giasullo from the Brooklyn Pharmacy and Soda Fountain. And we're talking about all the wonderful treats that they serve there at her soda fountain. Gia, you with me?
Yep, I'm right here.
Great.
Nice to be back.
So in addition to all those delicious treats that you have at the soda fountain, when I was there, I actually had an unbelievably delicious sandwich that was all locally sourced and organic. Mm-hmm. You want to share what else you have at your soda fountain?
Yeah. Well, always changing up, and we're actually in the process now of developing our fall menu, which the solstice is just days away. We're trying to work with the season here. We work as much as we can with sourcing our sandwich, and particularly the things that we're kind of running through on a daily basis, as local as possible. So, for instance, let's take the pastrami and rye. So we work with, starting with the bread, a bakery, Caputo's Bakery, which has been in Carroll Gardens for I don't even know how many years, but long time, just on Court Street. So our bread is picked up every morning, baked fresh every morning. The meat, the pastrami, is from Brooklyn Cured, which is a local, small company. They're curing and packaging meat in the most, the freshest, just gorgeous. I mean, see, we get the meat and we just sort of like look at it before we even start to slice it. The sauerkraut is from Brooklyn Brine. So they're a local pickling pickling company. The mustard that we serve with that is from, that's actually from Maine. It's a raise of Maine mustard. Again, bringing back the economy to Maine. And I think that's pretty much it. So we're like in one sandwich, we can talk about each one of the pieces that are going there. We had a wonderful sandwich this summer called the Franny, named after my Aunt Franny. And again, bread from Caputo's. We have a mozzarella that's delivered by hand from the guy who just made it down the street, Aiello's Mozzarella. We have tomatoes that come from the fresh fruit and vegetable market down the street. And the funny thing about it was, as we went in looking for a tomato for the summer, we were debating on farmers markets how to get in tomatoes, not too many. We're not serving up a huge lunch every day, so knowing that we wanted them fresh, but a small amount. We said, well, maybe it's fine just to go to our local fruit market. And funny enough, we're having a conversation with them. We found out actually that the tomatoes that he was selling came from about 10 miles of where we grew up in Maine. And so without even intending to, we, again, sort of our going back to Maine with our purchasing of our tomatoes.
Mm-hmm.
So we, all of our sandwiches, the things that we put into our soups, again, sort of conscious of where they're coming from as much as we can, liking to know what the story is behind the food. The soda fountain, I think one of the greatest things that we give and sell to our customers, it's not just what they're putting in their mouths, it's not just what they're buying, but it's the experience of being there. And so the story of what they're eating and what they're consuming is important. And it's important to, we think, know where things are coming from. And so as much as we can, try to find sources of food that has a story, has a person, a real person behind it, who's producing. That's fantastic for us because this is the values that we believe in, and fit into our overall story of the soda fountain.
Right, and you felt that the minute I walked in there, I knew this was not just a, your regular run of the mill ice cream shop where you're going to get Oreo cookies, out of a box and.
Right.
They're going to mix in with, Breyer's ice cream.
Which is an interesting thing. And I, just to bring it up, and one of the things, having written the book on the soda fountain, which, just to trace back, when we were asked to write a, quote, cookbook, we agreed to it with the idea that we wanted to tell the story of the soda fountain as a part of American history, because when we went to go look at the history of the soda fountain, it was lots of different stories in different places on the internet and in different books. They were all very heady. They were oftentimes pharmaceutical. There wasn't a story out there that was cohesive. But one of the things that we went through in our process is researching the rise and the fall of the soda fountain. And it wasn't, you know, you can't be so naive as to not look at that fall and apply it to your own business and say, well, are we going to be experiencing that fall? Why did it fall? And one of the things that we're up against a lot is that when you walk into our shop, you are being served the best ingredients. You know, again, we don't just pull things out of boxes or bottles and put them into a glass for you. You're being served in glass. You're not being served in a to-go cup. It's very rare to find an ice cream shop that will serve you in glass. It's an experience that it's almost rare to find unless you're actually in a restaurant. And one of the things that we come up against a lot as business owners from an economic point of view is there's a perceived value to a bowl of ice cream. You know, you might go into any restaurant and spend $12 on some baby greens, right, on a plate with a little bit of dressing, and you think nothing of it, or other things. I'm just using baby greens as an example. But when we create a sundae in front of your eyes with all organic and natural ingredients, with the highest quality of ice cream in a glass that's brought to you, and then your glass is washed after you leave, if we put a $12 price tag on it, which we do, you can see that people have to do a take on that because they're like, the perceived value is not high. And so it's been an interesting process for us around educating the people that walk in our doors what they're actually coming in for. And so that's what we kind of come back to, like, you're coming in for the experience. Part of that experience is sitting down, having someone bring you a glass of water and being served in glass, you know, the best ingredients that you can for dessert. So that's been an interesting process, and I think it's one of the reasons why the soda fountains went the way that they did is because they were up against fast food, they were up against drive-through, in paper, you know, watered-down milkshakes, and you can't compete with that. And so it's an interesting process. So it just means that we have to up our game in terms of what is the experience of being there. How do we serve the community in a large picture? And so that they understand the value of what we actually provide. I mean, there's many kids that walk into our soda fountain that we are their first relationship with a business. And it's our point to make it a good relationship. So if they come in, we teach them how to tip. You know, we teach them that actually, well, it says it's that much on the menu, but there's tax. Well, why am I paying tax? So it's a relationship that has value, but it's not just it's not just, and I'm sitting down and have an ice cream cone. There's a bigger picture here.
Which is a really nice picture and one that needs to be taught. And, you know, you've definitely, as far as I'm concerned, you're on the right path. It's the way, you know, it's the way to go. It's, you know, and I come up with it too. I feed, you know, I'm coming up to it soon. Every Thanksgiving I feed, you know, over 1,000 people out in a park, working with the River Fund Food Pantry. And, you know, they, to this day, they're still serving the food that I'm making in these styrofoam things with a folding top. And it's it drives me crazy when I know that I can get, you know, one of the cardboard ones that are biodegradable and not styrofoam. But the price difference is so huge, and we're giving this all away. This is all free and donated, so there's no monetary exchange at all. And so it's a real challenge to figure out how. You know, I mean, of course, we'd love to get the containers donated from someone. I'm going to start again this year, but I have not yet been able to find that. And it's, you know, it's tough, like you said. You know, it's a business owner trying to make those choices and do the right thing and at the same time, you know, be in business.
Right. And I think oftentimes it's really about the communication. I mean, we're doing our menu again for the fall. And one of the things that we're addressing now is actually getting better at communicating what we're doing. Because we know it and we have it in our minds and the people that work with us know it. But if you walk in our door, you don't know it. And I think that so much of that just starts with education about why you're doing this and the impact it's going to have And so it's a process. I lived for over 20 years in the Bay Area, and I've been back in New York, originally a New Yorker, but I've been back in New York for about 5 years. And it's still surprising to me that there's a lot of catching up that the East Coast needs to do still. Language.
Absolutely.
That is still being
years ago, I'm sorry. If you had said that, you were serving organic ice cream, some people would turn around going, oh, it's just so, she, or it's not trying to, they're just doing that so they can charge more. And now I think people are starting to understand the value of that and appreciating it more.
Yeah. Well, and it goes back to a treat being a treat. And so a treat has a value. And I think that when you cheapen a treat, then you feel like you can have it all the time, and that's a problem. So we're a treat, and our portions show that, and our what we're providing shows that. I think that I think it's education, and I think I even see it with every time I go clothing shopping for my daughters, I feel like I'm putting out less money in the moment, but there's almost nothing from last year that they can wear again. And that's upsetting for me. Like, I'd almost rather put in a little bit more and be able to not throw away something within 6 months because it's falling apart. And I think that's it's that consciousness of, people need to understand why. Why wouldn't I want to have something new or have something that's less expensive or have something that's cheap? So it's about telling the story. And I think that the storytelling and the communication is vital to people making changes, or else it just seems like it just costs more.
Right, exactly. I was at a store, and I'm listening to this old guy going, I don't understand this. The more holes, the more expensive it is. He's looking at jeans. I think he was someone younger, and it was just really a funny comment. Now, one thing that is, so many people have not heard of, young people, is an egg cream. You want to refresh people's mind what an egg cream is? Because that's, one of the favorite, soda fountain treats.
Yeah, and it's, if we could sort of trace back where any of this might have started. Our father was born in Queens, the treat in our house was a very simple one. It was an egg cream. And an egg cream is actually something you can make at home. It's three simple ingredients. There's a chocolate syrup, there's milk, and there's seltzer, plain seltzer.
Right, egg in it.
There's no egg and there's no cream in it, which is something that's, kind of the big question mark. Why is that? But the egg cream is, again, a quintessentially New York drink. It was, most people would not argue that it was, it came to its fame in New York City. You might have an egg cream in Texas, but probably you don't. And if you do, it's a transplant. The egg cream, most people would agree it originated in the Lower East Side. It was a drink that was, most likely invented by, an immigrant. Some people say it was a Jewish immigrant. There's not really anything on paper that says what's the exact history of this drink. We've come up with our own theory, which it's a funny thing because there's a lot of theories about the egg cream. So in fact, you could actually have a theory too, and it would just be thrown into it's like the Wikipedia of egg cream history.
Mm-hmm.
Our theory is that fresh milk and cream made its way from Hudson Valley 100 years ago in the same way it does now, and it probably reached the Lower East Side last. So I don't think that there was a lot of milk and fresh, fresh dairy products that were available. But what they were allowed to do was to have chickens on the roof. And so what we think happened is that some smart guy was selling chocolate soda and understood that if you put a dollop of egg white on top of it and called it an egg cream, that you could upcharge it. And it sounded nutritious, and it sounded good, and it sounded rich. And so that's what we think happened, is that originally it did have an egg in it in the sense of just a dollop of egg white. But that's our story. We think it probably began and ended with economics, but it was something that caught on. And right now, the way it evolved, it doesn't have egg or it has cream.
We are out of time, but why don't you just share with everyone really quickly where your soda fountain is so people can come and visit you.
Okay, sounds great. Do you want me to do that or do you want to do that?
Go ahead, you do it.
All right, we're at 513 Henry Street at the corner of Henry and Sackett in Carroll Gardens, Brooklyn, New York. And we're open 7 days a week. Thanks for having me on today.
You're so welcome. And everyone, check out the book, The Soda Fountain, by Gia and her brother, Peter Freeman. And you've been listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. Have a great rest of the week, and I hope to see you all at the People's Climate March on Sunday, September 21st. Have a great rest of the week, and see you Sunday.